supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this week. 5 years after it was proposed by former Delaware Attorney General Beau Biden, legislation aimed at keeping guns from some people with mental illness is now law in Delaware. WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports from the Delaware desk.
In 2013, then-Delaware Attorney General Beau Biden made a pitch to Delaware lawmakers for legislation designed to keep guns away from people with mental illness who may pose a danger to themselves or others.
Most of the mass shootings that have occurred in this nation over the last two decades, behind each one of them is someone who common sense and most psychiatrists or medical professional would say is a person who should not be in touch with or have contact with a weapon.
The late Beau Biden's April 2013 pitch for that legislation, just months after the Sandy Hook mass shooting, was unsuccessful. The bill got unanimous approval in the state House, but languished in the state Senate. 5 years later, inspired in part by student protests over another mass shooting, this time at a Florida high school, state lawmakers unanimously approved legislation similar to Biden's bill. Delaware Governor John Carney signed it into law Monday at the Biden Institute on the University of Delaware's Newark campus.
Today is as much a tribute to our beloved Beau Biden and the Biden family, a celebration of working together, as well as a testament to what makes Delaware special.
With some limitations, the new law prohibits anyone who has been committed to a hospital for treatment of a mental condition from owning a gun. It also makes gun ownership illegal for anyone who has committed a violent crime but was found not guilty for reasons of mental health. The bill is supported by the National Alliance on Mental Illness Delaware chapter, says Executive Director Josh Thomas.
We believe this offers a level of protection where people will not be singled out simply because they have a mental health diagnosis.
Former Vice President Joe Biden said the bill fulfills a promise Beau made to Delawareans and that the law's greatest impact might be in helping to prevent suicides.
Of the thousands of people who die as a consequence of gunshot wounds, the majority are self-inflicted. They are suicide.
From the Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
The current SEPTA token has been in use for half a century, but today is officially the last day the Transit Authority is selling the iconic metal transit coin as the transition to the SEPTA key card continues. What does this mean for commuters? Joining us now with more is Plan Philly's Jim Saxa. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Mary.
So for those of us who are loath to part with our tokens, what happens next?
Well, if you still have tokens, you can continue to use them. SEPTA is going to continue to accept them for a long time. But for most of us, the little pile is going to diminish over the next couple of days, and you can't refill that, right? So what you can do is get the SEPTA key. That's what SEPTA wants you to get, the new payment fare card system. But if you're loath to do that, you can also get a individual ticket. You can get the SEPTA kiosks that are set up all over. And you can still pay for a single fare when you get on your bus or trolley. That's $2.50. You're not going to get the $2 discounted fare. To get that, you need to use SEPTA key.
Hmm. What about transfers?
Transfers, no changes there. If you use SEPTA key, it will be automatic. It's $1. On the buses, you're going to want to ask your driver to get a transfer still.
The SEPTA key system was supposed to be fully in play in 2013, correct?
Yep.
So 5 years later, it's not fully in play. Why is that? Why the delay?
Yeah, so it all stems back to when SEPTA first started this process. They, you know, tried to do a very comprehensive bid document, and it turns out they missed a lot of things. And so they have gone back to their contractors and their consultants numerous times, more so than they do for any other project. Most projects, they go back two, three times, tweak some things. We're at the 18th change order at this point, and when you make that many changes on and on and on, it delays everything. So right now, SEPTA doesn't expect to have everything wrapped up and done with this project until 2020.
You know, back in the old days, if you wanted to give a friend a fare, you could just slip them a couple of tokens. Can't do that with the key, I guess.
No, that's going away. So SEPTA key, currently you can't tap for a friend. SEPTA says that they'll consider adding that functionality, but that might be another change order that I was just mentioning. But yeah, right now, if you want to pay for a friend, you're going to have to give them $250 in exact change.
So there are a lot of tokens out there still. As you said, there's really no end date as to whether when SEPTA is going to stop accepting these tokens. Just from an observer's standpoint, do you see these little things are becoming collector's items?
Well, yeah, what we've already seen is that a couple of companies have started or, you know, side projects to turn them into jewelry. And there are people that collect tokens the way that, you know, people collect coins or stamps. And I know some people have talked about when they're available in bulk, they would love to buy a bunch of them to use in art projects. So, yeah, I think we'll see them still crop up as sort of a symbol for the city in the next in the years to come.
New life for an old token.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Jim Saxa of Plan Philly, thanks so much for stopping by.
Hey, no problem.
Educators are becoming more and more aware of the impact trauma has on a child's ability to learn. In some schools in Pennsylvania, so many children are living with trauma that it can be overwhelming for schools. For Keystone Crossroads, Jen Kinney tells us of a new program in Philadelphia that's making connections between kids, families, and teachers to help them heal.
The fire that destroyed her dad's apartment is the scariest thing that's ever happened to 8-year-old Dakota Johnson.
I was on the first floor, and this guy was smoking, and he half fell asleep, and it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and me and my dad had to go to the hospital.
Dakota was okay, and so was her dad. He had just inhaled some smoke, but he'd lost all of his belongings. And Dakota...
I was crying a little bit, scared. I have nightmares about it sometimes.
And it wasn't just nightmares. Dakota's always been a bit of a shy kid, says her mom. But after the fire, she became a lot more sensitive. She started getting stomach aches, going to the school counselor a lot. She'd get scared that there could be another fire.
And that's really what trauma is. People think if you get hit by a car, that's the trauma. It's how you react to that event that becomes traumatic for you.
That's Natalie Dallard, project manager for a new program bringing trauma therapy to kids in Dakota's neighborhood in North Philadelphia, where gun violence and poverty are prevalent. The program is unique to Philadelphia in that it's completely free to all children in the neighborhood, regardless of their parents' insurance.
Residents realize that something was affecting them, something was affecting their children. There was a reason why there was so much violence. There was a reason why people were angry or hurt. There's a lot of people who are walking wounded, all living in this same neighborhood, and they recognize, hey, we need help with this.
Dallard hopes that this also makes a difference in Philadelphia's schools.
Trauma impacts the way that you learn, right? So if I'm in the classroom and I'm constantly worried about, is someone going to come through the door and assault me? I'm not focused on what's going on in the classroom. I can't sit still. And that we see with kids in classrooms often spills over into acting out behaviors which disrupt the classroom. You know, teachers are spending less time on instruction because they're having to, you know, do a lot of redirection with some kids. And then, you know, you just end up with a chaotic situation.
The therapy in this program isn't your typical lie down on a couch and talk about your childhood stuff like you see in the movies. It's a type of treatment called trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy, and it aims to give children lifelong skills they can use whenever trauma flares up. Levi Lee is the therapist for the program and will be working with those children over the next few years.
Some things just need to be healed, and you need to learn certain coping skills that you're not naturally born with to heal properly.
Lee actually grew up in the neighborhood, so he knows how important this program is and the barriers that can keep people from seeking help.
These are my people. This is my community. You know, I definitely seen my mom cry on numerous occasions because she worked two jobs and really couldn't afford to pay the rent. You know, my dad really being in and out of my life in jail. Dealing with those feelings, you know, as a young man growing up in Philadelphia, I understand.
And he knows he didn't always get the help he needed to process all that. As a therapist, Lee first teaches clients what trauma is. Then he gives them tools to help them relax. Next, he tries to get them to realize that some of their fears aren't grounded in reality.
Making them really notice what is a fact and also what is an opinion. When you're traumatized, sometimes you can get it mixed up.
Dakota, who started the program 3 months ago, knows how that feels.
Sometimes, like, I'm scared at night. And, like, I think there's about to be a fire, but there isn't.
After working with Lee, she has some tools to help now.
He taught me some breathing exercises. I had to blow my stomach up and then breathe out of my mouth slowly.
She's writing her own trauma narrative, and she's learning little mantras she can repeat to herself.
So I have to say it's not that deep three times, and then I say, why is it not that deep? Like, why being in a fire is not that deep? Because I'm safe, and I have breathing exercises.
To have a 9 or 10-year-old to know more interventions than an adult is major.
The program is aimed at children, but it's also designed to educate the adults in their lives about the effects of trauma. Lee talks to both parents and teachers.
Yes, teachers, y'all have a major piece of this as well. Because if you think about it, the client is with the teacher for 8 hours out of a day. It's a long time.
It's been 5 months since the fire now. Dakota doesn't have the nightmare so much anymore, and she's having fewer stomach aches. I ask her how she thinks she'll feel about it a few more years from now.
I'll still be, like, a little scared, maybe, but I won't be that scared, but I'll be a little bit scared.
For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Jen Kinney.
It's Sixers-Celtics at the Garden tonight at 8 o'clock, game one of their Eastern Conference semifinals series. Sixers coach Brett Brown says, I can't wait. This time around, Boston has home court advantage. Celtics are the number 2 seed, Sixers number 3. And as excited as fans are about this scrappy and surprising Sixers team, the Celtics aren't the Heat, which the Sixers, of course, took care of with seeming ease in round one. Here with us once again to lend a little insight and perhaps some prognostication is Marcus Hayes, sports writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Hello, Marcus.
Hi, Mary. Thank you for having me again.
Sure. So round two for the Sixers. They've had a lot of rest since they wrapped up with the Heat. What is it, 6 days now? You know, rest, of course, can be good, but not necessarily for momentum. The Celtics are just coming off a hard-fought first round with Milwaukee. Tell us more about this, Marcus.
Well, J.J. Redick, one of the Sixers players, their shooting guard, said today that, you know, he's been in a lot of series. He's a veteran, and he said he hoped that it didn't sort of cost them their rhythm. It's not a good idea, he thinks, to not play for so many days this time of the year. I would contend that considering where the Sixers were and who they are, it might not be such a bad thing. They're a young team, and I found that young teams can get their rhythm back pretty easily. But also, it gives a few more days for Joel Embiid to sort of get his game back and get used to playing with a fractured orbital bone, which happened near the end of the season and hindered him to a degree because he has to wear a specialized mask in their series win over the Heat, especially offensively. So, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, but I think much more a blessing for the Sixers.
So, Marcus, tell us about this rivalry. It stretches back, what, a half century or more to Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell?
You know, I happened to be, as a New York kid, a Sixers fan, and it broke my heart in 1981 when the Sixers blew a 3-1 series lead and the Celtics wound up winning that Eastern Conference final. Then the next year, they did they almost did it again. They almost blew another 3-1 lead. And then, but Andrew Toney, who had scored 25 points on the fourth quarter of a game in March in 1982, blew the Celtics out kind of by himself in game 7 in 1982, the Eastern Conference Finals. And that led to another great moment brought to you by the Boston Strangler, as the Boston media was calling Toney at that point, where the Celtics fans in Boston Garden were chanting beat LA, beat the Los Angeles Lakers with Magic Johnson. So, you know, there's these moments, you know, time after time after time. And then again, you know, 2 years later, after the Sixers won the title, Larry Bird and Julius Erving into this terrible fight, I believe it was in November of 1984, where the famous picture is them grabbing each other's throats.
Uh-huh.
That was in 1984. That was a long, long time ago.
Yeah, but still.
But for Sixers fans, it feels like it was yesterday.
Uh-huh. Passions are sure to run high during this series. Well, let's talk about whom to watch. The 2018 Sixers apparently have a full roster, but Boston is without their star, Kyrie Irving, who's out for the rest of the season. Is this, Marcus, a critical blow for the Celtics?
Well, yeah, you know, they've in the first game of the year, they lost their number one free agent, or I guess their number two acquisition, their number one free agent acquisition, Gordon Hayward. And they had traded for Kyrie Irving, who was having an MVP season. He's injured now. And now their kind of rising star, Jaylen Brown, will probably miss tonight's game with a hamstring injury suffered in Game 7 against Milwaukee. So there hasn't been a whole lot of consistency for the Celtics. The job that their coach has done has been just amazing. They're still a very good team. They have a lot of good players. But, you know, it's almost as if the basketball gods had opened up the gates for the Sixers to walk to the NBA Finals, because so many teams in the East have so many issues, and the Sixers are probably in the best shape of all of them.
All right, Marcus Hayes. So are you ready for a little prognostication then?
Sure, sure. I'd be surprised if it goes seven. Brad Stevens is such a good coach. Marcus Smart is such an elite defender. And the Celtics will get Jaylen Brown back, I believe, at some point. So I believe they'll probably win maybe two of their games here. But I would take the Sixers in six.
Okay. All right. We'll be in touch, Marcus. Enjoy the game.
Thank you, Mary, for having me.
Thanks, Marcus Hayes, sports writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News on Newsworks Tonight. Well, Prince would be pleased. Astronomers have announced the discovery of a potentially purple planet. We take a trip now with Franklin Institute chief astronomer Derek Pitts, talking as he does each week with NewsWorks Tonight host Dave Heller.
Derek, tell me more.
I'm constantly fascinated by the great variation in composition of extrasolar planets that are being identified by various satellites that are sort of looking around to see what's out there, scouting around the rest of the galaxy. And the Kepler spacecraft that we have spoken of numerous times has done a great job of collecting these. One of them comes from a particular star system, the WASP star system 104, and the second one of the planets in that star system of WASP 104, WASP 104b, turns out to be a really interesting hot Jupiter-type planet. This is the type of planet that's about the size of Jupiter, a gas giant. In this case, it's a little bit bigger than Jupiter, but it happens to be very close to the star, so it's called a hot Jupiter. As it turns out, the composition of the planet renders it to potentially appear purple in nature. But that's not the most exciting part of this. The most exciting part is that because of the chemical composition of the upper atmosphere of this planet, 95 to 99% of the light that it receives from the star is absorbed. So it turns out to be an incredibly dark object, a little bit larger than Jupiter, but very close to its own star, which, of course, is wildly unusual.
So that almost all of the light from its star is absorbed. Is it just that little bit of light that comes off of it that lends the purplish hue?
Yes, it is. That's because of the composition. Because of the composition of the upper atmosphere, in this case we're talking about potassium and sodium, that's what astronomers think would give it this color of purple.
Our Jupiter, you wouldn't use that descriptive hot because it's not in the same proximity to our sun.
Not in the least. Our planet Jupiter is at an incredible distance away, some 400 million miles out from the sun. And because of that distance, it's in a portion of the solar system that's on the cold side, like several hundred degrees below zero easily. The hydrocarbon atmosphere that's there is made up mostly of frozen ice crystals. And those frozen ice crystals are what lend the ability to the planet to be so brilliant in our evening skies as we see it, because those ice crystals of the hydrogen, helium, ammonia, and methane are reflecting a tremendous amount of light.
Derek, coming back home, let's bid adieu to April. Tomorrow is May Day, May Day. What does May Day mean?
Well, in that particular case, it means help, help, help. It comes from the French word May Day, which means help. But May Day, as we're thinking of it, the astronomical term is a cross-quarter day, halfway between the first day of spring, first day of summer. However, this particular day has other connotations for other cultures. If any of us, and I'm sure many of us are, familiar with Shakespeare's great play, A Midsummer Night's Dream, we know that that play takes place around the middle of June. Well, that's not midsummer for us. That's really what we consider to be the beginning of summer. However, in many northern European cultures, that's considered the middle of summer, May 1st being the beginning of summer. So earlier this month, we were gaining minutes of daylight at the rate of 2 minutes, 40 seconds a day almost. But once we get into June, that rate will dwindle dramatically until, as we roll up to the third week of June, it's down to just seconds a day that we're gaining, coming to a close of gain on June 21st.
I'm not ready to consider those implications just yet. Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Ahead this week, we're looking at an education issue that gets relatively little attention, residency enforcement. Our three-part series, Kicked Out, begins tomorrow night. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.